we have a Hands 8 development program. It's a training program for federal employees with strong executive potential, and intended to be an important feeding system into the SES. And yet less than half of the graduates between fiscal year 2005 and 2011 actually went into the senior executive service. Clearly we're not attracting the numbers, to some extent, I suppose, the quality that we were anticipating. And a principal reason for that, I think, are disincentives that were unintentionally built into the system. For example, SES employees only get pay increases if the Congress gives itself a pay increase. Well, the Congress hasn't given itself a pay increase since 2009, notwithstanding the fact that none of our constituents are aware of that. But SES has been stuck in terms of pay, while regular GS employees have continued to get pay increases. It's also true that they don't get locality pay, and they don't get other incentives that other employees get, and they're more likely to be geographically relocated.
It's interesting because it seems like many people in the House, many of your colleagues, want to cut federal pay now. How would this bill actually let senior executives perhaps earn more?
It would delink the provision that that they can only get pay if the members of Congress give themselves pay increases. But more importantly, the locality pay is fixed. We try to improve the work-life balance for SES employees, we try to enable them to get compensation for things like overtime pay, and bonuses and awards would be calculated in their high tree annuity calculation, because as I say, the pay compression is a major disincentive for people to go into the SES.
We're speaking with Congressman Jim Moran of Virginia. And what about the idea of mobility, people moving around from job to job? That's not part of the bill. Does that look like it's something that probably can't get through?
I talked with Max Deere, the Partnership for Public Service, at length, as well as the Senior Executives Association. And while theoretically I think that mobility should continue to be a major element of the senior executive service, because the idea was that you would get senior managers who would bring best practices from one agency to another and would get a more comprehensive perspective of the overall objectives of the federal government, and would not have their information and responsibility stovepiped. The reality is that it hasn't worked that way, and that mobility actually has undermined the incentives that we try to provide SES employees. So we had to take out the mobility requirement because there's only about 11% of the SES employees who were actually moving from one agency to another in the way that was intended. So we had to be realistic about it. And, you know, if the principal objective is to improve the quality and quantity of SES workforce, then we had to be realistic about it. Actually, I think it's 8% of senior executives have worked for more than one federal agency. Well, if it's not working, we need to be realistic about it.
I heard you speak at the release of the partnership's report, and at that time you said you wanted to sort of jolt senior executives out of their comfort zones. Does this bill do that in any way?
Not to the extent that my rhetoric would have implied, because I have learned from extensive discussions with the partnership and with SEA that have to be realistic here and understand that there are already too many disincentives to get into the SES, that if we don't fix it now and provide greater incentives, then it's just going to be a vestige of the past, a good idea gone awry that just didn't work out. So we're trying to really rescue the whole concept and the whole idea of SES itself, which was well-intentioned. But if we don't make pragmatic changes, then it's just going to be one more well-intentioned idea that will have dissipated to the point where it's virtually non-existent in the federal workforce.
Now, it's just before recess for Congress, and there's a lot of funding bills and appropriations bills, authorization bills. Everything's kind of half-baked. Not everything has gone through either House fully yet. What's your best take on what's going to happen to federal pay and benefits at this point, looking at the way the bills are shaping up before the recess and with the election coming up and everything else?
Federal employees have been a target and will continue to be a target of an element within the Republican majority who was elected on the notion that the federal government can't work, doesn't work, and now that they're elected, they're trying to prove that to be the case. And so to do so, they're trying to reduce incentives for people to stay in the federal workforce and reduce the number of personnel. I just had a bill that I'm the ranking Democrat on called Interior and the Environment, and here some of the Republican majority added additional responsibilities for the Environmental Protection Agency, and I had to point out that they have already cut the number of EPA employees below 1992 levels. And yet they want to put more responsibilities to be more cooperative with the states and with the private sector. I think they're creating what they know are impossible situations where the federal workforce at some point is going to understandably just fall short of what it's being required to do. So I object very strongly, but in order to protect the Defense Department from sequester. There are proposals in the Senate and the House to reduce the number of employees by one out of every three employees that are lost through attrition. Some would eliminate two out of every three positions that become empty.